Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Trail Culture. I'm your host, Em Robertson, and I'm so stoked that you're tuning in. Today is part two of the episode with James Montgomery from The Run Project. We are going to be talking about the craft of coaching, how to work with a developing athlete, and what makes a great coach. I am super excited about this chat, and as you all know, season two of Trail Culture is fueled by Carbon Endurance. They are an endurance sport consulting company. They really have you covered in terms of fuel and hydration for all of your performance needs. It's really amazing to be able to work with a team who understand athletes, understand the trail space, and are just working together to ensure that athletes can have their best training and racing performances possible. Really excited about that partnership. Go and check them out. The details are in the show notes. I hope that you guys enjoy part one of this two-part episode, and I'll see you back here next week for the next one.
I always just think like there's such a creativity to what they did, right?
Mm.
And it kind of gets to hopefully one of the questions that you sent through to me that hopefully we'll get to is kind of like what is a great or what makes a great coach? And I think part of that is creativity. It's problem solving and creativity. And for me as a coach, if something's not fun, then it's probably not sustainable for most people, because most people get into the sport for it to be fun, not to win. And of course, there's a very small minority who want to win races, but most people get into it because it's fun, right? That's how they get into sport in the first place. And so how do you integrate that into what they do every day? So you got to think creatively, because, even if you're in the most beautiful setting to go for an hour run, let's say you're running in Newlands Forest, it's one of my favorite places. If you go run for an hour in Newlands Forest, like if you have to do that every day, a lot of people will get bored, right? You have to have quite a like creative mind to make that interesting. So for me, if I run around Keurboom Sports Field, as an example, I should be able to make that fun and interesting. And so for me, that, if something is fun, you keep someone engaged. It's gonna allow you to make the long term consistent training adaptations that a lot of people lose by being overly structured too soon in their training. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I hear you.
And I think too often people also get a little bit stuck on data, believing that like we have more control than, as you touched on before, almost have like more control than you think you do about intensity or what exactly it is you're training. So like almost like let go of it a little bit. Like you have less control than you think you have. Let it be playful. Enjoy what you're doing. Be curious about what you're doing. And I think it becomes just a far more fulfilling journey for people.
Yeah. And something you said now, Monty, is like entering into structured training too soon. So we mentioned like continuity with an athlete working for someone for ages. And you do get some people who like love to like progress in a way and tick a box. And then you get other people who want to be like excellent and really dial into like one goal, whether it's like being the best marathon runner that they can be, or like 800 meter runner, or perfecting the VK attempt or whatever it is. So when you've worked with someone for ages like that, do you like yo-yo in and out of like very specific and like almost rigidly structured blocks and then out again to keep the fun? Or is it kind of like there's always a bit of like free range and like fun to the program regardless of what phase the athlete's in?
Probably depends on who you ask. You know, I think like maybe just a part of our process is like we coach your final surge, and I like final surge because it's not overly data intensive, and I write out everyone's workouts, right? So I like type them out, which maybe isn't the most efficient way to go about things. And obviously you have like certain templates that you can use and you tweak, but like if I'm creating like a blend session, like I'm typing it out, so like what I want them to do, right? And I guess someone could read that and say like, oh, that's very structured, like but in the way that I'm writing it is always trying to be creative, if
Yeah.
that makes sense. So I guess it's how someone onboards that, and I think people that know me well enough probably understand where I'm coming from. So I guess to answer your question, you could look at it one of two ways, right? You could look at it and be like, whoa, this person's overly structured. Or you could look at it and be like, oh, like actually someone's trying to be quite creative about, what we have access to. I coach a lot of people who might live in big cities and are wanting to do trail races, and we're using like a treadmill to get make things interesting,
Yeah,
and to
yeah.
try get the training stimulus that we're looking for. Or even people in Cape Town coming to Europe and you having to manufacture sessions.
Yeah.
And so I always try write it with a sense of fun and creativity. It might not always be received that way. But I guess to sort of answer your question more directly, I think it should always have a bit of both. And so you want to have an intention for a workout, but how do people learn? People learn by feeling and experiencing. And so I want people to go into sessions and make mistakes, because that's how
Yeah.
they learn. I don't want someone to go do a run and it's, I say, I don't know, do a 2x15 minute hills at what they perceive their 60 minute or lactic threshold to be, and they get it perfectly right. Because if they get it perfectly right, they're not going to learn anything, right? I want them to go a little bit too hard and make a mistake and realize that on the second rep. Because that's how they're going to improve, and that's how they're going to get to a race setting and be able to make good decisions. If
Yeah.
they go there and get it perfectly right, someone may say to you, yeah, but they're not getting the exact stimulus. And then I go back to the point of like, don't think you have more control than you do.
That's
Does
awesome.
that?
No, yeah, that answers my question. And I think the not having more control, it's like a, and you're almost like, thank goodness we don't have more control. Like, then it does take the fun out of it or the learning. Like, I think that's what keeps something exciting for me or sport. There's always something to explore, improve on. And if your overall experience is like most of the time when I go out and do this, I'm having a great sense of fun, even if I'm not necessarily nailing like the goal of the session, but I'm like really enjoying it, then that like keeps you coming back. Yeah, regardless of the outcome almost. Because it can't always be great. Like anything in life, it's not always gonna be wonderful. I think I can't remember who I chatted to. I think it was Johart, and he's like, yeah, people think like because I'm fast, I like love to time trial the whole time, or like that every performance for me is just like easy. And he's like, no, like I've had performances where like the reflection is, okay, I won. And he's like, and it was the worst race of my life, you know, like and there's moments where he's like, I had like a actually on paper a terrible race, but I had fun. You know, and so those things, I think that's just like important to remember. And Monty, like on the change thing, so we've got like keeping things interesting, keeping the element of fun, something that Meg mentioned last year in her episode, or was it this year? But anyway, I was like wanting to ask you about it or dive into it with her, and we didn't get to it, was she spoke about her physiology changing. So I was asking her about the Golden Trail circuit, and like she obviously performed like super well there, and then everybody went, you know, okay, then you totally like changed tack and went for like this longer distance. And she mentioned like you hadn't always coached her, and then you'd started working with her, and then she said something like, yeah, and you know, from what I was doing to where I am now, my physiology's totally changed. And then she kind of moved on, and I actually had quite a few people message me and be like, what did she mean? You know, can you ask her? And so I'm going to ask you as her current coach now. Yeah, like as the athlete, we've spoken about them evolving and growing, like almost like emotionally and mentally and goals wise, but like on a physiological level, what is she talking about when she's talking about like a change?
So I think what's important for people to understand is that your body is going to adapt to the training stimulus that it's given, right? And so like so let's say, for example, I go do, I don't know, a lot of like really long days in the mountains at a relatively easy intensity. If you think about the volume of that training stimulus, that's going to push my physiology into a direction, right? So I could do that, and every second week I throw in like a really hard VO2 max set. Those VO2 max sets, it's not enough of a training stimulus to make a dent, right? You need high frequency and a high dose of stimulus to create adaptation. So if you think about like what Meg's saying is that like for when she was doing Golden Trail series and maybe doing some more specific training towards a race lasting 4 hours versus a race lasting 12 hours, and that volume and that frequency of the training stimulus has now changed to be more long time on your legs at a more steady or moderate sort of effort. Well, her underlying physiology is going to adapt, right? And so when she says like her physiology is now more suited towards the longer stuff, that's what she means. And I would argue, I mean, I'd actually disagree with her in that sense. Not in the, in that's what's happened because it has, but in the fact that she is certainly capable of going back. And again, it would just take a shift in training stimulus. And a change in focus and intention. And I certainly think that would be possible. And the way I like to think about this is that, like, keep in mind anything within sort of 5 to 10% of the intensity that you'll be racing at is still fairly specific, right? And I'll give you an example. If you're training for, I don't know, a trail marathon versus a trail ultra, but let's say the ultra is closer to a 50K or 60K, the intensity that you can sustain for 50K or 60K, particularly at an elite level, versus what they can sustain in a marathon is fairly close to each other, right? So actually the training is still fairly specific. Obviously it might get a little bit different if you're training for UTMB and you're going to be out there for 24 hours. But if you're looking at races between, I don't know, let's say like 4 hours and 8 hours, well, the intensity is fairly similar. If you look at how the guys and girls race CCC versus OCC, it's a good example, right? And I really like the idea of if someone comes to you and says, like, I want to run a good, let's just go to the road because the maths is a bit easier. But if someone comes to you and says, I want to run a good road marathon, well, like 6 weeks before, I want them to be in really good half marathon shape. And then in that time, or 8 weeks, in that time, you can then take that and manipulate the stimulus required to take them from being really good in a half to being really good in a marathon, right? Because they're mathematically linked. And so similar principle here. And I think I still think Meg could race at a world-class level in the marathon. I really do. And of course, you know, she's got to want to do that. But I'm just saying from a coaching standpoint, it's totally possible. Does that answer the question? Does that
It
give it?
does. No, it does. It's really cool. I think it was like we mentioned way earlier in the episode, like Bruce Ford, I said that the best training you can do is choose your parents. So I think it's like people, it's like the genetics, physiology, it's like what was actually said. And it's cool for me that people are like taking note of that. And again, I think it's going to come as a shock to some people because it's like, oh, where should my training should or not like should. Where should my training look similar to my friend who's training for this race and where shouldn't it? And this is a cool thing for me where you're like, you're talking about Meg in this situation, and how you would view this and treat her. It's like specific to her physiology. And that's got to do with like training history and what she's done and her experience and like her training age. And that kind of doesn't play along with the copy paste or like general coaching approach. It's like a lot more specific. And I know that's something that I saw on the Run Project site as well, is like you won't find anything like copy paste about us, which I was like, that's amazing. And this applies to like the fun principle, everything. It like depends on who you're dealing with. You know, it's like what someone constitutes as fun might be like, yeah, I need a lot of freedom. I need a lot of autonomy to decide how I'm going to do something. But for a session to be fun for another athlete, it's like I need a lot more instruction or guidance because that's fun for me. Like within that safety of decision making, like that's fun. Where someone else is like, oh, don't put me in a box. So yeah, that's kind of what I'm hearing.
It's quite interesting. Like I sometimes give people like a traditional fartlek session where I give them no instruction. Well, I'd
Oh
just say for
yeah.
20 minutes, I want you to play with speed. And you can use everything from a 10-second sprint to a K moderate, right? And
Yeah.
everything in between. And some people hate it and some people love it.
Yeah.
And I like to do it as a little bit of a test because it told me where someone is psychologically, what they can handle. And I think one other thing that's really important, and a lot of people get this wrong. And if you look at Meg, Kane, Daniel, Llewellyn, and Yoat, they've all been running since they were 10 years old at a
Yeah.
very good level, right? So bear in mind, at a minimum, they've been training at a high level for probably 15 years, some of them for longer. You cannot replicate that, no matter how, and this is what often people don't understand. Let's say you get someone who comes to you and they're as talented as any of those individuals, right? But they don't have the training history. What's important to understand is that just because you can do a session doesn't mean that you need to do that session to improve. So if I'm coaching Kane and I know Kane's been racing and training at a high level in a structured way for 20 years, 18 years, whatever it is. And let's say he is, I'm going to go back to a road example just because the maths is easy again. Let's say Kane is a 28-minute 10K runner, okay? And someone else comes to me capable of running a 28-minute 10K, but is actually only in their third or fourth year of training. The training that Kane requires to make improvements should be significantly harder than the training someone who's at 3 years of structured training should be required to do, right? Because they have far more low-hanging fruits. And what and the mistake most people make is that they'll try and give those, because they'll say, well, the two people's PBs are the same. But actually, given how much training Kane has done, what would be required to make him improve and what would be required to make the other person improve is massively different. And so always think of it in terms of, like, what is the minimum effective dose of training that I can give this person for them to continue to improve? And when they start to plateau, then give them more. And too often, and I see this all the time in trail running, Killian came out of that famous session we did a VK and a 10K. And the first thing everyone misunderstands is that he did that. If you look at his times around his aerobic threshold or lactic threshold, somewhere between those two, right? So that intensity is extremely well controlled. Which means he can recover from it. He didn't go and race a VK as hard as he can and then go run a 10K as hard as he can. That's not what he did. Now, let's take someone else who's got a lot less experience. Let's take Bianca, who's, maybe he's like now probably at like 7 or 8 years of structured training. She doesn't need that same session to make her improve because she hasn't got that same training age. So she could probably
That's so
improve with
good.
doing a 500 meter vert climb, and then she comes down and maybe she does fartlek 10 times, 1 minute on, 1 minute off. Do you know what I mean? It's the same session, but you're structuring it for the person in front of you, not based on someone with 20 years of training history.
And
And
like
that's what people get wrong.
incredible genetics.
And incredible genetics. And so Killian's smart because he puts those sessions out there. And people copy them. Remy's copied them, et cetera, et cetera. But the reality is, it's digging those other guys a hole because they don't
That's just what I
understand,
was
like,
gonna
what.
say. And like, that what you're talking about for me, it's like the margin for improvement for someone like Killian is way smaller, and like that's how it should be. And like for B, for example, if we're comparing it to her, like there's loads of time for her to get to that session, if ever. Like the session's not the
100%.
goal, but it's like the low hanging fruit, the other things. It's like other stuff is more important. Also, to make sure you have the sustainability to get that person to a level where they could still do it, that you take her training age from 7 years to 14 to 20 to 30. Like, if you're just gonna go and kill yourself for those to say, oh, I did the same session as Killian, you might dig yourself into a hole you can't get out of,
Don't
psychologically
people far
injuring.
too often, but also people far too often try compress physiology. They try compress years worth of change into as short a time as possible. And we spoke about coaches. number of coaches do not understand that simple principle, and they rush athletes. And so what you see is you see huge improvements for a short period of time, and then you see, well, as you mentioned, plateau, injury, all that kind of stuff, burnout.
And I think so that's a good segue, James. Like one of the things I wanted to chat to you about is like the fads. So if it's Killian session, if it's like there was a thing at a stage, it's not, well, yeah, a couple of months ago, it's like double threshold days. It's like everyone was, I want to do double threshold days. And I have a lot of people come to me, not necessarily just my athletes, or I see people even approach my mentors, say in the sports science department, and they're like, yeah, there's this thing, you know, whether it's like lactate testing or double threshold days or the VK and the 10K, and like I want to do it, or like this session is gonna make me better. Like how do you approach the fads and like point people back to good coaching practice? And because there's also a line, right? Like sometimes something comes out and I'm like, I wonder if that's maybe not a fad. Because sometimes it isn't, and it's like actually challenging my. So, like a good example is I was very anti using like power as like a metric to measure performance in trail running for a long time, and that's I've got loads of reasons, blah blah blah, and like I was proved wrong since, and I've been convinced otherwise, and I'm like, okay, I was wrong, and I didn't understand it, da da da. But then there's other things where I'm like, that's just like, yeah, what, yeah. So I think. It, like that's just not good practice, you know? So it's like how do you identify fads or point your athletes away from doing things just for the sake of saying, oh, this person's doing it and they're winning and this is going to make a difference for me?
So I think number one, be open-minded. So be open-minded to be proved wrong, and to learn. And that can be hard. I think it can be hard for anyone. I think the other thing is to be able to be very clear about the history of the sports. And if you're clear about the history of the sport and you understand the fads through time, not even fads, just popular training philosophies over time, you'll see that most things have come before and are repeated. And double threshold, Mihaly Igloi in the late 1930s, early 1940s is a good example, right? But if you look at anything, lots of year two max work, well, Seb Coe and his father Peter in the 1980s, right? These things come and go.
They just like packaged a little bit differently.
They just package a little bit differently, right? And if you look at, let's say, double threshold example, so for me, what did I do? Well, it was fascinating because number one, I knew about Igloi. So I was like, okay, cool, let's go back and look at what Igloi was doing. And then understand like how did double thresholds how did that become popular amongst the current group of Norwegians, right? And if you look back and you see oh, his name flipping escapes me now, but there was a Norwegian athlete that was coached by Peter Coe. And Peter Coe gave him lots of VO2 max work. He was a 5,000 meter runner. His name's going to come to me straight after this podcast. It's going to irritate me. Anyway, Marius Bakken. So Marius Bakken was coached by Peter Coe. A lot of VO2 max work started to plateau, and he wanted to play around with more threshold work because he had reached a plateau and he had been doing a lot of VO2 stuff. So he did a lot of double threshold stuff, started to see improvements again. So we asked ourselves the question, like, well, what was he previously doing? Lots of VO2 stuff. What was a new stimulus? Lots of double threshold stuff, right? Okay, so we know the VO2 stuff is like drinking a Red Bull. It's pretty potent, but it wears off pretty quickly. Okay, so now he starts to see a lot of improvements. And then when he adds back in the VO2 stuff of its massive aerobic capacity, well, his time starts to improve. So it's not necessarily that it's purely double threshold, it's what he did previously, what he adds in, the new stimulus, what that changes his physiology to do, and then what it means he's not doing as much of, well, the VO2 max stuff. So then when he adds it back in, then what is a new training stimulus again. So
Yes, it's just
it,
this variation. It's like mixing different ingredients at different moments, you're going to have different outcomes.
exactly. It's not that any one thing is right or wrong. It's context dependent. It's
Yeah,
another
so
tool at your
good.
disposal. So explaining that to the athletes is that, like, so now let's say double threshold is the fad. Well, are you Jakob Ingebrigtsen training for 1500 or 5000 or 10K cross country? Well, no, you're not. So like, let's really understand for him. Let's say he knows he can handle 6 weeks of VO2 stuff leading into a championship like the Olympics. What is he going to do the rest of the year to keep a high level of aerobic fitness based on the type of athlete that he is, which is more slow twitch resistance type? So that's going to suit his physiology better. And so he can do that for throughout the year, then have small doses of intensity. He can race quite frequently off actually just large amounts of threshold work. And then I think the other thing that's important is bear in mind, like, if you racing a race that's going to last you 4 hours, and you doing, I don't know, let's say you split your double threshold work into 30 minutes in the morning and 30 minutes into the afternoon. One must ask yourself, you get high frequency of the training stimulus, but what is more specific? 1 hour of that work or two times 30 minutes? Bear in mind your race lasts 4 hours. Bear in mind, Jakob's race lasts 3 minutes 30 or 13 minutes. So in other words, one needs to look at the duration that these guys are racing at, the amount of volume and frequency of work they can then achieve by doing double threshold versus someone who's racing even a road marathon. I'd argue double threshold is less valid as a specific training stimulus for someone racing a marathon than it is for someone racing a 5K. So in understanding, like, double threshold is not good or bad. It's context specific. Same as VO2 max work, same as lactic tolerance work, right? You don't need, Jim Walmsley doesn't need to do, I don't know, four times 400 as hard as he can with a minute rest. Well, what, that's going to add no value to him at all, right?
If he's training for to complete the UTMB lap, yeah, context
100%.
specific.
The last part I wanted to add to that is if athletes come to you and they're wanting to try something, is like being open to let them trying it, but making sure that they understand why you do or you don't think it's necessary, and then structuring in a way that may be valuable, right? And so, like, I don't know, you could do the double threshold thing as an example, or let's say like Killian's VK 10K. I gave you the example earlier of maybe how you could structure that, like shorten the climb, do it fartlek style, and then maybe drop down and do something similar on the flat, but again, like 10 times 1 minute at their half marathon intensity with 1 minute easy. So, like, give them the session, but give it in a way that you think is valuable, that fits in with where they're at and what their goals are. I think that's, so you're listening, but you're not just blindly copying what someone else is doing. But I think it's really important to be able to explain the history, because the reality is most people don't have the time to go and read up about the history of the sport as much as you as a coach may have, and then for coaches is to make sure that you understand that history. Make sure that you understand the pitfalls of any specific philosophy, because there are enough examples of success, but also enough examples of failure. So I think that's one thing. And really to ensure that you understand that for every one person that stands on a podium that tells you how great one thing is, there's probably hundreds of people who could tell you how that failed them. So it's just because we see the success stories, right? Like, I mean, Jakob didn't win the 1500 at the Olympics, right? So yeah, he won the 5K, but he didn't win the 1500. And in fact, he wasn't even on the podium, right? So it doesn't mean he's a failure. Christian Blumenfeld, who won gold at the previous Olympics and obviously also does a lot of threshold stuff. What was quite fascinating was he obviously went up to the Ironman, had great success at the Ironman, and tried to come back down for Paris to the Olympic distance. And listening to an interview with him post the Olympics, where I think he was 10th, and obviously very disappointed with his results, one of the things that he said was, I did too much threshold work. And so, like, no one puts that in, like, in the headlines, right?
No one wants to hear that. They just want to hear about the thing that worked and it was great. And if I do it, it'll work for me.
Exactly.
Oh, it's great. Monty, so much. There's been so many things that I'm like, I feel like you've kind of answered the question, but I'm gonna see if you can deliver it in an elevator pitch style. What I'm hearing is like, you must be able to sit on the fence. You need to listen to your athletes. You need to separate your own like ego from their goals and what they want to achieve. But I mean, it was a loaded question when I sent it, and it still is now. But like, what do you think makes a great coach? Like, when athletes are looking for that fit, trying to make a decision, and there's lots of options, like, yeah, what makes a coach great, and in your mind would like set them apart as a as an obvious choice to trust?
So I think critical thinking is exceptionally important. You don't want to take someone else's training philosophy and call it your own. That's not coaching, right? And I think if you look at all the great coaches over history, they were all critical thinkers and they were all problem solvers. In other words, they had a set of constraints, environmental constraints, athlete-driven constraints. And those constraints is what ultimately led to what we look back on and call a philosophy. Lydiard, Canova, now Bauman, Igloe, all the great coaches through history didn't sit there and write out on a piece of paper, "This is my coaching philosophy." They all had a set of constraints that they worked around to create what we now look back with and say it was a coaching philosophy. Does that make sense? So I think like that ability to critically think, to communicate well with athletes. And I think the other thing is like you want someone with life skills. And I think too often I see people, and this is not to have a dig at young coaches because I was a young coach and I was given opportunities. But it's important to understand that like writing a training program is such a small part of what we do, right? It's dealing with the everyday life of someone, the psychology of someone, what's happening in their personal lives, what's the level of stress, what's happening with their sleep. And until you've experienced those things yourself, I think it's very hard to try and put yourself in someone else's shoes. So I always find it funny when I see, someone who's in their early 20s and they're telling people that are in their 40s with kids and full-time jobs about how much training they should do. And you kind of think like, that's a lot because until you're in those shoes, and I don't have kids, so I can't even talk to that. But
Yeah, you're not
I
gonna be like, I have the same expectation for you to sleep this much that I do for my 20-year-old athlete with no obligations or stress, you know?
Exactly. And then I think the last one, and I think this is one that I still need to learn is like, don't be afraid to lose clients. And I think so often we, because it's our career and it's, what we need to put food on our table, it's you become too scared to lose people. And sometimes you have to be able to say, actually, what you're doing is, doesn't sit well with me. And once you've obviously tried to explain that and be honest with them, but I've got myself into situations coaching people that's just the fit wasn't there. And sometimes you just got to accept that the fit's not there, and that's okay. You're not going to be perfect for everyone. And to be able to be honest with them and call it. And I think it's
That's
still
great.
something that I'm working with myself, but I think it's a good one.
That's epic. Yeah, so good, Monty. There's been like so many pockets of things here that I'm like gold nuggets that people are hopefully picking up. And before I let you go, Monty, one question. I each season has had its thing of like the little round off question, and I started off, I think, with what is your favorite trail and why? And Meg looked at me like I'd asked her to choose her favorite child. But this for you, or my new one for this season is, what is something that you've read that has inspired you recently?
Geez, that's a good question. So I think something that really resonates with me, I'm naturally quite an anxious person, and well, it's quite funny because one of the things I read is don't talk about being an anxious person but having anxious feelings. So almost like to separate yourself. But I think one of the things that I find super fascinating, so I've kind of done quite a deep dive into curiosity and mindfulness. And It's a take on something I've read, not necessarily straight from something I've read, but essentially that life's not of, about avoiding uncertainty. It's about learning to walk alongside it with curiosity and empathy. And
Wow.
I think for me that's it's applicable to so many different areas in life, right? It's like obviously anxiety is. It comes about of like the fear of uncertainty, and we spend so much time trying to avoid it and trying to like, for me, like problem solve my way around it. And so what I love about that is like, it's not about not having fear of uncertainty. There's always going to be uncertainty, but it's about learning to walk alongside that in like a curious way and a kind way to yourself and to others. And for me, why that resonates, because it's not only in everyday life, which is obvious in your job and relationships and all these things, but also in dealing with people that are racing, because racing is ultimately always uncertain. We can't control our competitors, we can't control the environment, the weather, the trail, all these things. All we can control is our mindset around dealing with those. And yeah. So it's a takeaway from a book I'm reading called Unwinding Anxiety by a guy called Dr. Judd Brewer. And it's really resonated with me. So that'll be
Epic. That's
my
your choice.
little
I
takeaway.
love that. I'm trying to like, what are people reading? It doesn't necessarily have to be about running, and then I'll stick it in the show notes. It's awesome. Monty, thank you. This has been super valuable, I think, for the listeners, for me. I'm really glad we could make this chat happen, and thank you
Yeah,
for
thank
all your
you.
time behind the scenes. Monty has split this up over a couple of days due to Yonkersuk styled weather interference. So yeah, I really appreciate it.
And
And
Chamonix style. So it's was this mountain town style.
The
Like it
perks
was.
of living in the mountains. It's great. But thanks, Monty. It's really been great.
Yeah, absolute pleasure. Thank you for all your time and all you're doing for the sport.
Awesome. There you have it, everyone. Part two with James Montgomery from The Run Project. Such a great coach to be in conversation with. I feel like I learned so much about working with the individual in front of you, the different aspects to consider when it comes to training and racing in order to keep it sustainable, and just that fun really needs to form part of the way that we view the sport. I hope you all enjoyed this episode, and I'll see you back here next week for our next one.